KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This fight is about more than just our financial rules and regulations. This fight is about more than just Democrat versus Republican politics. This fight is about hardworking people versus the billionaires who want to squeeze more and more and more money out of them.
As President Trump hands more power to Elon Musk, we look at how the world's richest man could personally profit from shutting down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, among other agencies. Then, are we sleepwalking into autocracy? Is Trump embracing the authoritarian handbook of Hungary's far-right leader, Viktor Orban? And we talk to the British-Pakistani writer, Tariq Ali, as Trump repeats his threat to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population.
Some of us were naive enough to imagine that capitalism was about competition. It's actually about hegemony and who rules the world. And that effectively is what Trump is doing. We can do what we like. No one can stop us. Who can stop us?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened to renew Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip, drawing fear among Palestinians and condemnation from world leaders. On Tuesday, Netanyahu delivered this ultimatum to Hamas.
The decision that I passed unanimously in the cabinet is this. If Hamas does not return our hostages by Saturday noon, the ceasefire will end, and the military will return to intense fighting until Hamas is finally defeated.
Netanyahu's threat comes after repeated Israeli violations of the terms of its ceasefire deal with Hamas. Gaza's health ministry said Tuesday 92 Palestinians have been killed and 822 wounded in direct targeting, they said, by the Israeli military since January 19th, when the ceasefire went into effect. Palestinians say Israel's granted access to just a small fraction of the humanitarian aid and fuel it pledged to allow into Gaza. On Tuesday, the United Nations estimated more than $53 billion will be required to rebuild Gaza and end its humanitarian catastrophe. President Trump has repeated his claim that the United States is preparing to take control of the Gaza Strip and own it while permanently displacing the territory's entire population of more than 2 million Palestinians. Trump made the comments as he hosted Jordan's King Abdullah for talks on Gaza at the White House Tuesday.
We're going to have Gaza. We don't have to buy. There's nothing to buy. We will have Gaza.
What does that mean?
No reason to buy. There is nothing to buy. It's Gaza. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it.
After meeting with Trump, King Abdullah wrote in a statement, quote, I reiterated Jordan's steadfast position against the displacement of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. This is the unified Arab position, the king wrote. Meanwhile, the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has postponed a planned visit to Washington, D.C., scheduled for next week, after Trump threatened to cut off aid to Jordan and Egypt unless the countries agree to receive the Palestinians expelled from Gaza. A senior Egyptian diplomat told the New Arab newspaper, any cut in U.S. aid would threaten Egypt's 1979 peace treaty with Israel. The family of Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya, the director of Northern Gaza's Kamel Adwan Hospital, confirmed he was finally granted a visit with his attorney nearly 2 months after he was abducted and detained by Israeli forces. In a statement, the family described Dr. Abu Safiya's accounts of severe abuse and torture by Israeli soldiers, including 24 days of solitary confinement before his transfer to Ofer prison. His family said he's only given one meal a day. Israel has not filed any charges against Dr. Abu Safiya. In a statement, his family writes, quote, He urges the world to help secure his release and the release of all detained healthcare personnel from all hospitals. They must be protected, their rights ensured, and they should receive care and be released as soon as possible, they said. President Trump signed an executive order Tuesday ordering massive cuts to the U.S. federal workforce, with a team lead from the Department of Government Efficiency assigned to each federal agency to oversee firings and new hires. Trump's order gives even more power to Elon Musk and his Doge operation in what Democrats and legal scholars have condemned as an unconstitutional power grab by the world's richest man. On Tuesday, Democratic lawmakers joined federal workers for a protest on Capitol Hill demanding congressional action. This is Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees.
We are here today to send a message, a loud and clear message to our senators and our representative here on Capitol Hill. And the message is this: save the civil service and save the country.
On Tuesday, Elon Musk and President Trump spoke to reporters from the Oval Office. Elon Musk standing alongside President Trump, who remained seated at the Resolute desk. It was the first time Musk had taken questions about his Doge operation since Trump tasked him with slashing trillions of dollars in federal spending. Musk repeatedly rejected reporters' assertions that Doge operates in deep secrecy.
So all of our actions are maximally transparent. In fact, I don't think there's been, I don't know of a case that where an organization has been more transparent than the Doge organization.
The White House said Tuesday Musk is serving as an unpaid special government employee, and therefore his financial disclosure report is not required to be made public. The White House has also worked to shield Musk's operation from open records laws, including the Freedom of Information Act, by invoking the Presidential Records Act, which would see Doge records kept secret, sealed, until 2034. The New York Times reports there are more than 32 continuing investigations, pending complaints or enforcement actions into Musk's six companies across at least 11 federal agencies that have been affected by the Trump administration's purge of civil servants. Musk is also a major beneficiary of NASA and the Department of Defense funds, with SpaceX reporting it's received about $22 billion in government contracts. On Tuesday, Musk repeatedly denied his vast business holdings presented a conflict of interest.
If you have received billions of dollars in contracts from the Pentagon, and the president's directing you to look into the Department of Defense, is that a conflict of interest?
Yes, which we definitely need to do and are going to do at the president's request.
Does that present a conflict of interest for you?
No, because you'd have to look at the individual contract and say, first of all, I'm not the one, you know, filing the contract. It's people at SpaceX.
Musk spoke with his four-year-old son, X, that's X-A12, sitting on his shoulders, often putting his fingers in Elon Musk's ears. The White House has fired Paul Martin, the inspector general for the U.S. Agency for International Development. Martin's abrupt termination Tuesday came a day after his office warned in a scathing report that moves by Trump and Elon Musk to defund USAID has put nearly $500 million worth of food aid at risk of spoilage as it sits idle in ports, ships and warehouses. Like Trump's purge of 17 other inspectors general last month, Martin's firing appeared to violate a law requiring the administration to alert Congress 30 days in advance. A federal judge has issued a temporary restraining order preventing the National Institutes of Health from implementing severe cuts to research funding imposed by the Trump administration. This comes after 22 states, including Massachusetts, filed a lawsuit Monday arguing the move would eviscerate studies into treatments for cancer, Alzheimer's, heart disease, and other chronic conditions. The top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee has accused Trump's pick to head the FBI, Kash Patel, of committing perjury during his confirmation hearing. When Patel testified, he didn't know about the Trump administration's purge of top officials at the FBI. This is Senator Dick Durbin speaking during Senate debate on Tuesday.
According to my whistleblower sources, Mr. Patel is receiving information from within the FBI from the director's advisory team. Mr. Patel then provides direction to Stephen Miller, who relays it to the acting Deputy Attorney General Beauvais. It is unacceptable for a nominee with no legal or current role in government to personally direct the unjustified and potentially illegal firings of dedicated nonpartisan professionals at the FBI. If these allegations are true, then Mr. Patel may have committed perjury before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
The Senate Judiciary has scheduled a Thursday vote on whether to recommend Kash Patel's confirmation to the full Senate. In Memphis, Tennessee, shocking new surveillance video shows four masked men in plain clothes hauling away restaurant workers in what city officials later confirmed was a raid by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. A social media account for restaurant owner Taconganas, Memphis, posted the video online with the caption, "We don't know if the men you see in the video work for ICE or for someone else. You'll see they have no uniforms, do not show any badge or ID, and did not leave any identifying information or paperwork. If not for our security cameras, we would not even know this happened," unquote. This comes amidst Trump's mass deportation efforts and after prosecutors in at least three states have in recent weeks charged people with impersonating immigration law enforcement officers. The cases include a South Carolina man arrested for kidnapping a Latinx driver following a racist confrontation, and a North Carolina man accused of using the false threat of deportation to extort sex. Meanwhile, more than two dozen Christian and Jewish groups filed a lawsuit in federal court Tuesday seeking to prevent ICE agents from conducting raids at houses of worship. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, soldiers with the M23 insurgent group on Tuesday launched heavy attacks on Congolese army forces, breaking a two-day pause in fighting. M23 is now advancing toward Bukavu, another key city in the eastern DRC. Many residents were forced to flee amidst fears of an imminent M23 attack with schools and stores shut down.
Our school was badly hit. In fact, I don't know if you've seen the other side. Even the buses that transported students were damaged. When you arrive here, you wonder, will life ever return to normal? Will the children be able to focus on their lessons after everything they've witnessed? The bomb fragments, the destruction, seeing where the bullets landed? Will the students truly settle back into their routines?
U.S. school teacher Mark Fogel has arrived in the United States after his release from a Russian prison following 3.5 years in captivity after he was charged with carrying a small amount of medical marijuana. President Trump welcomed Fogel to the White House Tuesday night and said Russia would free another U.S. prisoner today without giving their name. Asked what Russia got in exchange, Trump said a fair deal, but would not elaborate. The White House blocked a journalist with the Associated Press from covering Trump's signing of a new executive order Tuesday after AP refused to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. AP senior vice president and executive editor Julie Pace said in a statement, quote, "Limiting our access to the Oval Office based on the content of AP speech not only severely impedes the public's access to independent news, it plainly violates the First Amendment," unquote. AP Stylebook is used by journalists and other institutions worldwide. The U.S. Geological Service has officially adopted Gulf of America, as have Apple and Google Maps, when searched by users in the U.S., caving to Trump's executive order signed on his first day in office. And President Trump has directed the Treasury Department to stop producing new pennies. The proposal is raising further alarm on executive overreach as it's Congress which authorizes the manufacturing of coins and oversees U.S. mint's operations. Elon Musk Doge has also lashed out at the cost of production estimated about 3 cents per penny. Meanwhile, Trump has ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to revert to previous standards for light bulbs, as well as toilets, showers, and other appliances that consume water. During his first term, Trump gutted longstanding water efficiency EPA rules, which were then brought back by the Biden administration. The changes came after Trump in 2019 claimed Americans were having to flush their toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once, and complaints by Trump that shower heads didn't have enough pressure. Trump's also issued an executive order banning the federal use of paper straws, saying they don't work, and that he wants his government to exclusively use plastic. The transition back to plastic straws has drawn alarm from ocean conservationists worldwide. Researchers estimate some 15 million tons of plastic enter the world's oceans each year. This is Komang Sudiartha, founder of an anti-litter group in Bali, Indonesia.
I'm very disappointed. An advanced country should be able to give a good example. They should be able to limit trash production. But if they're back to using plastic straws, they're going backwards. The impact is, in countries like ours, we'll have to double down on how to reduce our own trash, especially these plastic straws.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump signed an executive order Tuesday to give more power to the world's richest man, Elon Musk, who's been leading the effort to dismantle numerous government agencies, including USAID and the Commercial Financial Protection Bureau. Musk heads the newly established DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, which claims it's looking at ways to reduce government waste. But a new investigation by the New York Times reports Musk has been targeting many of the federal agencies and officials who've been engaged in investigations of Musk's own multiple companies, including Tesla, SpaceX, Neuralink, and the social media platform X. The Times reports, quote, at least 11 federal agencies that have been affected by those moves have more than 32 continuing investigations, pending complaints or enforcement actions into Mr. Musk's six companies, unquote. On Monday, hundreds of protesters rallied outside the offices of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau after Trump and Musk moved to shut down the agency's headquarters and cut off its funding. This is Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who's credited with creating the CFPB.
Look, these damn billionaires are making their moves right out in the open. Look at Elon, please. No, just look. He invested $288 million to buy an election for Donald Trump. And now he is right here to collect on that investment. Elon Musk owns X, which has been losing money like crazy. So Elon has a plan for a new payment platform called X Money. Elon wants X Money to touch every part of your financial life. But Elon has got a problem. The financial cops. The CFPB is there to make sure that Elon's new project can't scam you or steal your sensitive personal data. So Elon's solution, get rid of the cops, kill the CFPB.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts speaking at a protest outside the closed headquarters of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We're joined right now by Julie Margetta Morgan, the former Associate Director for Research and Monitoring and Regulations at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She left a few weeks ago. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Julie. Can you explain, I mean, all the information that's coming out right now, first of all, what the CFPB does, who it does it for, and what Elon Musk has to gain? This week, all the workers got a stop work order and they closed the headquarters. And, oh, let me just say one other thing. Sure. Didn't Elon Musk say on his social media platform X, he just put out CFPB RIP with a tombstone?
Thank you for having me today, Amy. You know, this is really critical for all Americans. The CFPB is the place where Americans could go when they were scammed by a payday lender, or when they couldn't get inaccurate information taken off their credit report, or when big banks like Wells Fargo were opening fake accounts in their name. And the CFPB again and again delivered for American families. This over its entire history, the CFPB has returned $21 billion to American families. So, you know, this is a little agency that was punching well above its weight. And then just a few days ago, you know, Donald Trump and Elon Musk took control and shut the agency down. So we went from a place where you know, in the last week before Trump took power, the CFPB was ordering big companies to return millions of dollars to consumers to a place where the agency is doing nothing at all. And you raised the role of Elon Musk here. I think this is a fact that we really have to focus on. Elon Musk himself wants to run a payments company. He has said from the start that he plans to turn X into essentially a bank. And he's taken steps in that direction in the last few weeks, including a partnership with Visa. The thing that stands in his way is having strong regulators who will make him play by the same rules as every other bank. Luckily, he has access to the entire federal government, and he's able to simply shut those regulators down. So the actions over the last few weeks have been incredibly bad for individual, everyday Americans, but incredibly good for Elon Musk's pocketbook.
And for those people who are not familiar, could you talk a little bit about the battle to get the, to create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau only in the aftermath of the financial meltdown of 2008? Did the Obama administration move to create it? But it's always faced enormous hostility, hasn't it, from the financial, especially from the financial community?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's incredibly important to know that the CFPB was born out of a financial crisis that started in the mortgage markets. So before the 2008 financial crisis, we didn't have a cop on the beat watching what mortgage servicers, particularly non-bank mortgage servicers, were doing. And as a result, we ended up in a massive financial crisis that took us years to dig out of. President Obama, Elizabeth Warren, and others worked together to create the CFPB. It was created in a bipartisan fashion, but it's had a target on its back from the start. And, you know, particularly when I was at CFPB, when we went out and talked to consumers around the country, there was nothing partisan or controversial about the CFPB when it came to the work that it was delivering for Americans. The only place where CFPB is really controversial is in Washington, D.C., with big bank lobbyists and tech company lobbyists. So from the start, they've had a target on CFPB. I think this is one more step in their plan to get rid of the agency, and they've never had more power to be able to dismantle it.
And in terms of the some of the biggest achievements, could you enumerate some of them for our listeners?
Sure. So, you know, CFPB has achieved some really big achievements for individual consumers. I think the our crackdown on Wells Fargo that ended their campaign of issuing fake accounts in people's names is a really big one. But just in the last couple of years, we've had some really big wins for families, including a credit card late fees rule that limited late fees from $30 to $15, a rule that limited overdraft fees to $5. And I think really importantly, taking medical debt off of people's credit reports. So in the time that I was at CFPB, we did a lot of research on the impact of medical debt. And we found that a lot of the medical debt that was being reported on people's credit reports was inaccurate. And then people were being hounded by debt collectors over debts that they didn't owe. So these actions are incredibly consequential for American families. And now they're all being put at risk by Donald Trump and Elon Musk's agenda.
Let's go to Elon Musk. In this very odd news conference, that President Trump sitting at the Resolute desk and Elon Musk standing next to him with his child on his shoulders held. This is Musk.
Democracy. This may seem like, well, aren't we in a democracy? Well, if you don't have a feedback loop, FKX, we'd have to, if you sorry. So tell you, gravitas can be difficult sometimes. So if there's not a good feedback loop from the people to the government, and if you have rule of the bureaucrat, if the bureaucracy is in charge, and then what meaning does democracy actually have?
So, Julie Margetta Morgan, if you could respond to what Elon Musk said at that point, his child just standing next to him.
I think it's incredibly bold for him to stand there and suggest that he's creating a feedback loop between the people and the government. The CFPB itself was a feedback loop between the people and the government. Individuals could actually file a complaint on CFPB's website and have the certainty that the agency was going to, you know, look into that complaint and not only resolve it for them individually, but also look at broader actions by the companies that people complained about and take action through our enforcement or supervision divisions. So Elon Musk is actually doing the opposite of what he's claimed. He's shutting down those feedback loops for people, and he's doing it for his own personal gain.
So Julie Margetta Morgan, as we wrap up, at this point, how can the CFPB, can it be resurrected? And if you could finally comment on Russell Vogt, the head of the OMB, who was one of the chief architects of Project 2025, how that fits into the shuttering of CFPB.
Yes, Russell Vogt is in charge of the CFPB right now, and he's taking an axe to all of the pieces of CFPB that have been the most helpful for consumers. To your original question, it's not too late for CFPB. I expect that we'll see action in the court. I believe we've already seen a few cases filed here, because I think it's just really important to know that the actions they're taking are illegal. You know, the CFPB is responsible to Congress for completing certain activities, including having a robust supervision program that's kind of like the cop on the beat inside of the largest institutions. And so, you know, as much as they're doing the best that they can to dismantle CFPB right now, these actions are illegal, and I expect we'll see the court step in.
Julie Margetta Morgan, thanks so much for being with us. Former Associate Director for Research, Monitoring, and Regulations at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She left a few weeks ago. Coming up, are we sleepwalking into autocracy? Stay with us. Mexico by Steve Earle. Trump renamed the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America in an executive order and declared February 9th Gulf of America Day. This week, Google and Apple changed the name on their maps for U.S. viewers, while other sources for online maps have not followed suit. And AP says it was blocked from covering the Oval Office because it did not change the name in its AP guidebook from Gulf of Mexico to Gulf of America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to an expert on autocracy who says the Trump administration's moves to gut the federal government, shape the judiciary, and punish critics are all following a well-known playbook, not just the right-wing policy blueprint known as Project 2025, but the autocratic playbook of Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Today, in an unprecedented move by a European leader, Orban hosted the leader of Germany's far-right Alternative for Germany party, AfD, ahead of an election in 2 weeks, even as other Western leaders have sought to contain the party. At least one key member of Trump's new administration has closely studied Orban, the controversial far-right pundit Sebastian Gorka, who previously worked at the Hungarian Ministry of Defense before Orban and is now Trump's deputy assistant to the president's senior National Security Council director for counterterrorism, a top post that did not require Senate confirmation. Gorka advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary. This week, Gorka addressed a security forum.
If you share our values, you are on Team Western Civilization. Not just Western Hemisphere, Western Civilization. President Trump stated the following: the only question of our time is if we have the will to defend and save our civilization from those who wish to destroy it. If you believe that, the next 4 years will be beautiful for you and America.
This comes as candidates for top national security positions are now facing questions that appear to be a Trump loyalty test, including whether they accept his false claim that he won the 2020 election. For more, we're joined by Kim Lane Shepley, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government, focusing on Hungary. Her recent guest essay for The New York Times is headlined, "Are We Sleepwalking into Autocracy?" Professor Shepley, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you answer your question? What are you seeing in this country as you lived for many years in Hungary and what you saw there?
Yeah, well, so first of all, nice to be back with you. Unfortunately, we're under very difficult circumstances. And so I think it's really important in looking at how democracies fail these days. And the crucial thing to say about Hungary is that it was a robust democracy, sort of top of its class in Eastern Europe in 2010, when Viktor Orban came to power. And by the end of that decade, virtually all of the democracy raters rated it as no longer a democracy. I would say the collapse happened even faster. Really, Orban did almost everything to undermine democracy for Hungary's future just in the first 3 years. So as we're looking at what's happening now in Washington, one of the things we see is this everything, everywhere, all at once attack on all of the pillars of democracy. And that was exactly how Orban did it. Came into power while he'd been out of power for 8 years before he was elected in 2010. He had private law firms, private groups write a blueprint so that when he was, as soon as he took office, he could hit the ground running and just, you know, come out with thousands of pages of laws with all kinds of programs that hit sort of every sector of civil society, of the economy, you know, all at once. And that's exactly what we're seeing here is that kind of playbook.
And Professor Shepley, I'm wondering, it's in your studies, is there any essential or qualitative difference between an autocratic government and a fascist government? Does it even, is it even worthwhile to make the distinction? What's your sense?
Yeah, well, so I tend not to be very big on labels in this area, in part because as soon as you define what each of these regimes looks like, someone like Orban, who actually does read and actually is pretty knowledgeable, unlike the U.S. president, who, shall we say, probably hasn't gotten all the way through a book in a long time, Viktor Orban knows what he's doing. And so as soon as you label him something, he will do something that misses, you know, item four on what you have to get the label. So I'm a little nervous about the labels. And, you know, fascism, I think, it also means an ideology. What I'm concentrating on when I talk about autocracy is the system of checks and balances that allows for the future rotation of power and that prevents it from being captured by one political faction. Now, you know, governments that are trying to capture all the levers of power can have all kinds of surface ideologies. Now, what we're seeing is that Trump is even echoing a lot of Orban's rhetoric. So if you think Orban's a fascist, you probably think Trump is as well. But for me, the really crucial thing is, you know, are you eliminating checks and balances? Are you eliminating the things that allow future elections to be free and fair. And what we're seeing, I think, you know, as Trump has come to power with this blitz, with this program, this Project 2025 program, written by private actors, you know, while Trump was out of power, is that he's attacking the nerve centers of American government. I think one thing we've missed is that, you know, the first places that Elon Musk went into were the Office of Personnel Management, so controlling the entire federal workforce, the Treasury controlling all of the payments, as well as the budget, you know, in and out of money, in and out of government, and then the General Services Administration, which controls all the buildings and the facilities, but also all the IT. So they went first into these nerve centers, and we still don't know exactly what they've done there, but it seems as people are trying to figure out what they've done, that they didn't just steal data, but they also did things like put spyware on the computers of people at Treasury. So they're monitoring everything that those people are doing. They're building a kind of centralized dashboard that can be, you know, looked at from the White House and you know, allow the president, or Musk, if he's the ex-president, as I think we should call him, to allow the people in the White House to exercise direct control over federal agencies without going through any intermediaries, any Senate-confirmed appointments, or any checks and balances on the system. Now, Orban did that too. He centralized everything in the office of the prime minister. The cabinet secretaries became, if not irrelevant, then certainly not where the action was. And it's that really sudden and extreme concentration of power that I think we have to keep our eye on and be very worried about.
And can you talk about Orban's role in terms of Project 2025, the Danube Institute, and its relationship with the Heritage Foundation, and also his attempt to become a center for right-wing movements throughout Europe?
Yeah, exactly. So first of all, you know, when Project 2025 came out, I sat down and read it, and the first thing I thought was, you know, this sounds so much like what Orban did. And then it turns out a month later, there was a terrific article in the New Republic that made the connection. So Orban has this English language think tank. It's called the Danube Institute. You can Google it and see what it's up to. And the Danube Institute had entered into a formal agreement with the Heritage Foundation to actually provide consulting on how the Trump people were going to copy what Orban had done. In the meantime, you know, when Orban gives his Hungarian language speeches, one of the things he keeps saying is, you know, we are deep into the Trump administration and, you know, involved in its, you know, central planning. So you put all this together, and it's actually not just that the Trump people are aping Orban from a distance. It's that Orban has actually been involved in the design of Project 2025. Now, this mirrors, you know, what Orban has also done in Europe. So the European elections, the elections to the European Parliament, were held last June. And Orban's Fidesz party spent more money on campaigning for fellow far-right parties in other countries, like not just in Hungary, but in countries all over Europe, than any other single party in Europe. And remember, Hungary is a tiny country, you know, 9.5 million people on the edge of Europe. They're advertising in Germany. They're advertising in France. They're advertising in much bigger countries. And it turns out that this advertising, along with the general, you know, sort of collapse and weaknesses of party systems across Europe, meant that the far right had victories really all over the place. And Orban was able to take those far right victories and cobble together what has become the third largest political party in the European Parliament. And so that's an incredible political accomplishment. And what you're seeing is that Orban is now sort of riding atop this wave of election victories across Europe and claiming to be, you know, the heart and soul of this new far-right movement. He was president of something called, rotating president of what's called a council in the last half of 2024. And when he unveiled his presidency, the slogan was, "Make Europe Great Again," which was also the slogan of this far-right gathering that we just saw in Spain as Orban pulled together all these far-right parties. So, you know, Orban's a prime minister of a tiny country on the edge of Europe, but he is now punching far above his weight in trying to consolidate this movement of anti-democratic far-right forces.
This is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban welcoming Donald Trump's inauguration last month.
The stars under which we stand now are much more favorable than they were in 2024. Not only we became stronger, but in the meantime, the flagship of the Western liberal politics had sunken. The Western world received a patriotic, pro-peace, anti-migration, pro-family president in Washington.
So if you could respond to what Orban is saying, Professor Shepley, but also one of the things you point out is that you have these authoritarian leaders that don't just take power. I mean, even Hitler won an election. Orban won an election. And then what that process is consolidating the power, so much so that right now President Trump, what is it, hundreds of executive orders? But isn't that a sign of weakness, not strength? I mean, he's got the House and the Senate. Why can't he pass these laws and not get around them with Republicans in the majority in both houses?
Right. So actually, if you remember, in Donald Trump's first term, he had even larger majorities in both houses for the first half of his first term. And even then, he did not move to legislation. So I think part of the reason is that Trump wants to move fast. Orban also wanted to move fast. You know, Orban, in his first year in office, amended the Hungarian Constitution 12 times, changing 60 different provisions of the Constitution. Orban had a supermajority in his parliament, so he was able to work with them. Trump has got razor-thin majorities now in both houses. Also, amending the U.S. Constitution is beyond the bounds of almost any single political party. So Trump is doing something else, and this is the crucial thing about the autocratic playbook. It doesn't look exactly the same in every country because not the political systems don't look exactly the same. So Trump is trying to break things quickly so that by the time the courts catch up with him, by the time his own party starts to have second thoughts, by the time all of the forces that are checks and balances regroup and figure out how to push back, the thing will be broken. You know, so I think what Trump has learned and what Orban also, I think, taught him is that, you know, think of government as an aquarium. If you just stick a blender in it and make fish soup, you're not going to be able to restore the aquarium, even when courts tell you, no, you shouldn't have done it like that. So this is really, you know, break things first, act fast to create facts on the ground. And then when especially the judiciary is slow to catch up with you, you can't do anything. So let me give you one example from Hungary. In order to capture the judiciary, what Orban did was to suddenly lower the judicial retirement age from 70 to 62. And in Hungary, like most European countries, the judiciary is a civil service activity. So you come in as a baby judge, you get promoted through the ranks. The people who are the oldest are also the most senior. So you suddenly lower the retirement age, effective like today. All these judges are forced out of office. They then bring a lawsuit saying, you know, we were improperly, illegally fired. A couple of years later, the European courts get around to saying, yes, that shouldn't have happened. This is a violation of European law. By that time, Orban's filled all the positions. He goes back to the court and said, well, do you want us to fire the new judges? At which point, the European Commission, which is enforcing this court decision, says, well, we really don't want you to fire any new judges. Just give the new judges protection so that this can't happen again. Okay? And what that meant, he captured all the courts and got European blessing for it all because he moved first, broke things. And this is what we're seeing. You know, Trump is just creating facts on the ground. He'll destroy agencies before the court tells him you have to restore them. So again, the metaphor is you start as an aquarium, you create the fish soup, and no court can make you go back.
We just have 20 seconds, but what about if these federal workers, if the heads of agencies simply refuse to leave, create the constitutional crisis on the other side, the judiciary has to rule, and instead of ruling years later when all these people are gone, they rule now, and the agencies don't get shut down.
Yeah, well, a few of the officials who have been fired have tried to make a last stand, you know. Some of the inspectors general did, and the head of the Federal Election Commission did. The problem in Washington is that they can just deactivate your badge at the door. So in Poland, when the judges went back into court after their retirement age was lowered, they could get into the court. But in our government, It's very difficult because the buildings themselves have so much security. But still, I think it's good for people who were in office to say, I'm not leaving until you force me, and just create friction in the system. Slow it down is actually the best defense in circumstances like this.
Professor Kim Lane Shepley, want to thank you for being with us, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government with a special focus on Hungary. We'll link to your piece in the Times. Are we sleepwalking into autocracy? Next up, Tarek Ali. We speak to him as President Trump repeats his threat to take over Gaza, not buy it, just have it, and ethnically cleanse the entire population. Tarek Ali's new book, You Can't Please All. Back in 20 seconds. By the Rolling Stones is about our next guest, Tarek Ali. Mick Jagger wrote it for Tarek. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatened to renew Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying the Israeli military will return to, quote, intense fighting unless Hamas agrees to release all remaining hostages by Saturday noon. This comes after President Trump said all hell is going to break out if the hostages aren't freed. Hamas has accused Israel of repeatedly violating the ceasefire. Meanwhile, Trump on Tuesday met with Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House, where Trump repeated his threat to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population. Reporters questioned Trump about his Gaza proposal.
Mr. President, you said before that the U.S. would buy Gaza, and today you just said we're not going to buy Gaza.
We're not
going
to have to buy. We're going to have Gaza. We don't have to buy. There's nothing to buy. We will have Gaza.
What does that mean?
No reason to buy. There is nothing to buy. It's Gaza. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it. We're going to hold it. We're going to cherish it.
You're going to take it under what authority? It is sovereignty.
Under the U.S. authority.
That was President Trump sitting next to a grimacing King Abdullah of Jordan, who later wrote that they will not accept the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And the president of Egypt, President Sisi, canceled his trip to the White House next week after these comments. We're joined now by Tarek Ali, Pakistani-British historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, author of over 50 books, including just out, You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us on this side of the pond. But I do have to ask you, Mick Jagger wrote that Rolling Stones song for you, Street Fighting Man?
Yeah, he wrote it and sent it to me, a handwritten version, saying, could you put this in the paper? I just wrote this for you. I edited a radical newspaper at the time. And the BBC are refusing to play this song. So we did publish the song. And of course, a few weeks later, the BBC did play it. I mean, that was a time when politics and culture, radical politics, radical culture, were very mixed up together in a good sense.
So let's go back to Gaza. You have President Trump quadrupling down, saying he doesn't even have to buy Gaza. He'll have it. He'll take it. He's also said, originally said, the world's people will be there, yes, including Palestinians now. No, Palestinians have no right of return. Your response to what's going on there?
It is so appalling, Amy, what is going on now. Trump says it in public, what his predecessors used to say in private.
that effectively they're going to let Israel have its way, both in Gaza and, believe you me, in the West Bank. They will both be ethnically cleansed. That has been Israeli policy for decades, and now they feel they've had leaders in the United States. Trump is, of course, shameless and open about it. Biden did exactly the same thing. For 6 months, Hamas had agreed to the ceasefire plan. Netanyahu didn't want a ceasefire, and Biden backed him. So one problem we have today, that the reason you have Trump is because the previous administration was so weak-willed and so weak-minded, incapable of doing anything, whereas in this very country we had Reagan, Bush, Truman calling Israel to heel when they exceeded what was considered to be decent, honorable, according to the United States policies. When they refused to obey, they were called to heel. Neither Biden and now Trump calling these people enough. The whole world is seeing what you're up to. Enough. We will not tolerate it. Netanyahu threatening to break the ceasefire, and the response of the United States president is what? The response is nothing to do with the ceasefire, but we're going to take Gaza. We can. The Israelis have got it for you by killing over 100,000 people, and now we'll do with it as we please. I mean, if this is the way the United States empire is going to carry on functioning, there will be more and more, not immediately, there will be more and more resistance. If even the King of Jordan and Sisi in Egypt, who have so far backed the United States, are getting slightly scared, it's not because they've changed greatly, it's they're scared there will be an uprising in their countries. Jordan is three-quarters Palestinian anyway, and the Egyptian masses are seething. So we have a really extremely serious situation building up in the Middle East, where they publicly, in front of everyone, want to expel the Palestinians. No cover-up. Netanyahu says we're going to do it. The U.S. president supports him.
And Tarika, the famous Palestinian-American intellectual Edward Said was a friend of yours. You write about him in your memoir. Said was prophetic in many ways in terms of his skepticism of the possibility of a two-state solution. What are your sense of how he would have responded to what's happening today?
Well, Edward was a very dear friend. We often discussed Palestine. And he felt, as did many others, that the only serious solution for that region was a one-state solution with equal rights for all its citizens, male, female, Jews, non-Jews, etc. That was the only way we could proceed, because a two-state solution had become a joke. I mean, if you look what's been happening in Gaza for a year, an open genocide. If you see what they're starting to do to the West Bank now, a two-state solution is impossible. No one will believe in it. But a single-state solution has also now become very difficult, in my opinion. It's the worst situation to confront the Palestinians. I mean, 70%, between 60 and 70% of the Israeli population back Netanyahu. You have large numbers of Zionist citizens of Israel coming out and chanting once again, kill the Arabs, just like many German fascists shouted, kill the Jews. What is going on? And the U.S., in my opinion, is completely abdicated its role to be an arbiter. It never was an arbiter, but now that's just become a complete joke. So the situation seems grim to me, and whether it can be resolved simply within the area currently Israel-Palestine, or whether it will have to expand and extend to the rest of the Arab world before people see sense, is an open question.
And I'm wondering, as you mentioned the situation in Israel, clearly we just had a segment talking about authoritarianism in Europe as well, the rise of fascist and right-wing movements through, and especially anti-immigrant movements throughout Europe. What is your sense of the role or the problems in terms that the left has had in confronting these movements?
The real problem, Juan, is this, that all political parties, prior to the rise of these extreme right parties that the professor was talking about, prior to that, we had a center-left and a center-right. Both of them supported the economic system we call neoliberalism, a very extreme, rampant type of turbocharged capital, which wrecked the social structure of many of these countries, privatized large industries, entered into the domains of health, most sacred and hallowed sections of the old post-Second World War state. And that collapse, and the fact that parties of the center-left and center-right, whenever they came to power, did exactly the same thing. I wrote a book called The Extreme Center about these groups. They've now been shown to be what they were, which is useless. So there's a great hostility against these politicians, and there is nothing on to the left of them in most places. France is an exception. And what people do now is turn to the right, saying, we've tried all these jokers out. These guys are talking what seems to be our language. Let's see what they're like. And from that point of view, this big turn to the far right, in a sort of curious way, it's fitting that the champion now sits at the White House, the most right-wing president in recent years, especially on the domestic front. So there is a symbiosis taking place between the European far right and the far right government we seem to have got in the United States, and how they will work together. I mean, one problem they have is, and this should be talked about, that Zelensky's government in Ukraine, its hardcore are not just people who are far right, but they are actual lineal descendants of Ukrainian Nazis who have been fighting. We shouldn't forget that too. It's part of the picture. Just because the West is backing Ukraine doesn't mean that these things are not going on there. So it's very difficult to give this a gloss. What is happening in the West as a whole is pretty disastrous. It's not just Orban. He's very open, like Trump. Yeah, this is what we're doing. We don't care what you think. We're going to do it. We've been elected. We have the power to do it. There are people like that, but there are another layer of people who supposedly oppose them, who, when it comes down to it, have policies which are not all that different. I mean, what the United States and much of Europe needs today is an opposition which fights back politically, intellectually, with arguments, and when necessary, comes out on the streets, extra parliamentary actions to defend democracy.
We just have 30 seconds. The most important message following up on that, rising up at the grassroots, you feel people need to hear around the world now from your decades of activism.
I think we need activists more than ever before. I mean, one of the most amazing things has been this opposition by students in this country, occupations of universities in defense of the people, the Palestinians and the people of Gaza. We now need to extend these movements to what is happening domestically.
We're going to continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Tariq Ali, Pakistani-British historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review. Latest book, You Can't Please All.
the law. Come on, you lazy steamer, move on. Oh, here's that river, here we come. Watch her smoke, boy, hear that engine hum, and Lordy, take off.